This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The obituary section has long been a staple of newspapers. In larger cities, only those considered significant are guaranteed to have their obituaries printed. But in smaller cities and towns, almost all local residents have their passing noted. Obituaries are important for the deceased. They act as a kind of period on the end of the sentence that was their life. But they also act as a salve for those left behind, summing up the lives of loved ones and answering key questions about those lives. Who were they? Whom did they love? What were their contributions to their community, their family? How did they make a difference? All of that and more can be found in a good obituary. There's an art to writing these things, and on occasion, readers may find out about something or find out something about a loved one they never knew just by reading a well-crafted obituary. Today, we're going to look into the art of summing up a life with two people who have written obituaries professionally for years. Ken Garfield is now Director of Communications for Myers Park United Methodist Church, but he wrote for the Charlotte Observer for part of his time. He wrote obituaries for the Observer for part of his time there, and I think still contributes in some way to writing obituaries through your work at the church, right?
Every now and then, I left them a bank of obituaries, and every now and then one will run.
That's right. We'll talk about that in a second or two. Welcome back to the program. Also joining us Andrew Meacham, president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers and chief epilogue writer for the Tampa Bay Times, and he joins us from Florida by phone this morning. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
I love the title, Andrew, chief epilogue writer. Is that what the Tampa Bay Times calls obituaries, epilogues?
It's a feature that came about in 2007. Basically, they decided to add a kind of feature special obituary for people, just regular folks, you know, who didn't necessarily have to be prominent, just on the premise that everybody's got a story, and we are looking for that story, whatever it is.
And is that how you approach it, Ken, when you write somebody's obituary, whether they're famous or not, telling their story?
Telling their story and trying to capture what they meant on this earth in five or six or however many words you get to do it. To sum up a life, a legacy, the meaning of that life, what mattered to that person, what they celebrated in life, to go far beyond the resume and the career and the civic work and all the survivors, which you need, but to really, once you read this obituary, you understand what this person's life and legacy was about.
Let's define what we're talking about. We'll use the Observer as an example because that's the paper people here know most. When you open the obituary section of the Observer, there are death notices and there are also these little photographs and then little two or three paragraphs, sometimes a whole column about a person's life. Is that the job of the obituary writer or writers at the paper, or is that the work of the family?
That's the work of the family, typically in concert with a funeral home. Typically, the way it works is you really haven't written it in advance. You've suffered a loss. You have tears in your eyes, and you sit down with a funeral home director and with your siblings, perhaps, and you craft an obit as quickly as you can. You may be an insurance salesman and a car dealer, and you're really not a writer, and you're in a rush, and you have tears in your eyes, and you crank out this obituary that, to me, doesn't really do justice to most any life. And so what I'm doing is I'm trying to come in and develop a ministry, writing people's obituaries somewhat in advance. I will do them after the fact as well. That really captures what that life is like.
So for the purposes of this conversation, the obituaries that we are talking about are what?
Really the everyday people. I mean, we can talk about
But where do they appear? If the things that we're looking at in the paper, if I open the paper, and I did open the paper this morning and looked at the obituary section, which I actually do every day. The older I get, the more obituaries there are.
Oh, I hear that all the time. Yes.
In this morning's paper, for instance, and I'm assuming that you looked at it, is there a crafted obituary by somebody like you?
Typically not. It's a rather rare occurrence. And, they're fine. You get to understand where they worked and where they lived and where they traveled and who their survivors are. But you don't perhaps understand that person. So what I'm proposing, what I'm doing, is writing obituaries that would appear in that column. Now, you know that's paid space. You have to pay for an obituary now, and the more words, the more you pay. So I think there's being a good steward as well and being writing in a concise sort of way that I think actually helps and deepens the quality of the obituary.
How did this tradition of obituary writing start, particularly obituaries in the newspaper, which is where they most frequently appear, although even some small market radio stations do obituaries of the year? How did this start?
Andrew might know better than I.
For a while, yeah. If you look at tombstones, particularly in England, you know, back going into the centuries old, you'll see little stories about people. They may be only a couple of lines. Sometimes it's about a wife and mother who died early, or I saw one recently in a book about epitaphs, a guy who got lashed to the whale that he had harpooned and drowned sometimes, or typically about soldiers who died, but they were a good family person. So I would say that's an early form. Even going back to Egypt and Greece, sometimes you saw little stories on sarcophagi about accomplishments somebody had done. But in print, I'm guessing late 19th century, a little feature, very, very spare compared to what we do now. And then the newspaper gradually became a place where you could published death notices, and you didn't have to necessarily make funeral announcements by mail anymore. So the newspaper has played a role in how people even announce death.
Hmm. Is that if you go into an older cemetery that's 100 or 200 years old or more, you'll read a little bit about the lives of many of the people buried there because it's engraved on their tombstone, as Andrew mentioned a second ago. That's pretty much stopped today. Today it will say the name of the person, maybe father, mother, son, wife, whatever, and then date of birth, date of death. Is that because all the pertinent information has migrated elsewhere? Is that why?
I think so. And what we're doing, and Ken and I and others, are something that even came about more recently, which is the so-called common person obit. And to me, that started in the early 80s with a guy named Jim Nicholson of the Philadelphia Daily News, and then especially with the Philadelphia Inquirer, who had been an award-winning investigative reporter, relegated to obituaries after one of his investigative stories got too close to the paper he was working for. Hmm. And obituaries had typically been sort of the graveyard for writers going out to pasture or a place for newcomers to cut their teeth. And so nobody noticed what he was doing. It was like Jack and the Beanstalk, and he started writing these beautiful stories about everyday people. The guy that delivered ice, you know, by horse. The town drunk who had a heart and everybody liked him, but he just kept going out and drinking. The nun, the guy that didn't have anything but gave it all away anyway. The lawyer for the mobsters who seemed to find a way to win. And, just gorgeous little stories. And it took off. And then in England, of course, there's a whole other thread going on that's equally interesting and has grown parallel.
I was going to ask about the people who write obituaries for papers. I always thought it was a place for young people to get their, hone their craft a little bit. They're brand new to the paper. They stick them in the obituary section, and they learn how to write brief, pithy, factual paragraphs, and then they move up the ladder. Is that how the Observer has handled it?
Well, I think the appeal of beats goes up and down. Actually, when I left the paper in 06 by choice to go to work for a church, I said, I'm interested in covering the industry and culture of death, and if you created a quote-unquote death beat, mm-hmm. I would be very interested in staying and do that, the kind of music that people play at their funerals, the rise of cremation, the cost of dying, writing obituaries, how that has changed. I was very interested in the culture of that. they couldn't quite come up with a full-time beat for that, so I left the paper. But I think it's much more in appeal now because I think people see it as a place of wonderful craft, of wonderful writing. I mean, I tell people that most of what I wrote at The Observer ended up in the red box at the end of the street, except the obituary, which is carefully cut out and wrapped in plastic and put in someone's memory book. And I always took that as a very heavy responsibility. Mm-hmm. How can I sum up the life, like Andrew says, the ordinary life, ordinary on the surface, extraordinary in reality, and how can I craft a piece that really sums that up?
Well, not everybody gets these every man, ordinary man obituaries that we're talking about here. How do you choose who gets it and who doesn't get it? Because, you know, thousands of people die every week.
Well, as we all know, newspapers are in crisis. There are less people that work there. There's less space for news. Jerry Hostetler, my late friend, used to write these pieces for The Observer. She passed away, yeah, and they don't have a piece like that anymore. So there are less obituaries in The Observer. What you're reading are the paid obituaries that read often just like resumes. So there are less of them in The Observer. There just depends on the editors and the reporters at different papers and how much of a premium they put on it.
Andrew Meacham, you are the president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers, which covers everybody who does this in North America, I understand. Do most of these professionals work at newspapers, or are they finding their ways into other media?
Actually, only a few of us do at the moment. It's still a fairly small association. We're trying to increase our numbers. But because of the rate of newspapers kind of in decline, it's a lot of people are freelancers, but they get regular work. And as far as how what you were addressing a moment ago, how you do it, I try to keep a mix going, regional, within our coverage area, ethnic, demographic, economic. And within that, I look for stories, just what sticks out, what interests me. The most rewarding kinds that I do are the ones often where maybe the people only had room for a free obit or a very minimal one, and you can find that story beneath it and be able to tell it, because it's easy enough to take somebody where somebody spent, you know, $800 or $1,000 or something for one of these massive obits, and then they have so many accomplishments that, you know, at least a couple of paragraphs of the one you do, mm-hmm. just can't leave that stuff out. You know, if somebody was a state senator or whatever, I mean, you can't just omit that. But the real pleasure in it is particularly being able to find the stories that otherwise wouldn't be told.
And how do you find those stories? Both of you have done this. How do you find them? Because if you're writing particularly about ordinary people, you don't know them.
Well, I've written some for members of our congregation that know that this is a calling and an interest of mine. I've written some from people around the community. My theory and principle about life is that everybody has a rich story to tell, and everybody's story deserves to be told. So I've done some very simple people who live very simple yet sweet and rich lives, and there's always something interesting. There's always a nugget that raises the level of interest of that piece. But my theory is that every life is interesting. Remember the old CBS piece where the guy would open the phone book and just point to a name and do a story on that person? I kind of believe in that. I believe that everybody has a story to tell, and I do now that I don't work for a newspaper, so I don't have to do prominent people. I kind of gravitate and embrace doing the ones of people who have lived quote-unquote ordinary lives, and they are not ordinary, and that's the beauty of these.
You ever find yourself going down a dead end? Pick somebody out, get in the middle of researching it, writing it?
No. Now, some obits are shorter than others. Some people have less, they've just done less stuff, quote unquote, but it's still rich and beautiful.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more from Ken Garfield and Andrew Meacham. We're talking about obituaries this morning. We'll share some of your thoughts as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Honda Hickory, offering new and certified pre-owned Hondas to the Charlotte Metro and Western North Carolina on Highway 70 in Hickory and at HendrickHondaHickory.com. Long ago, Charlotte evolved from a city of meat and three restaurants to a city offering foods from all over the world, and we've been kind of keeping track of this evolution over the last several years. Every once in a while, we like to visit with three of the people who make it their business to know what's new, what's coming and going, what's good, what's not so good. They are our city's most read food critics, and we have coaxed them back into the studio to tell us more of what's happening on the Charlotte restaurant scene tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a recent House bill to block the NSA from collecting millions of phone records was narrowly defeated. Growing concerns over the scope and oversight of domestic surveillance programs.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ken Garfield is in our Spirit Square studio. He's director of communications at Myers Park United Methodist, formerly with the Charlotte Observer, has written his share of obituaries over the course of time. Andrew Meacham is the president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers and the chief epilogue writer for the Tampa Bay Times. He joins us by phone from Florida. We got an email from Kathleen I want to share with you. Alas, she says, I have learned of the interesting and varied lives and experiences of members of my church family only upon reading their obituaries. I have long believed that we all ought to write and share our obituaries while we are still very much alive. Think of the wonderful interactions engendered by such sharing. This is one of the things we wanted to do this program for. A really good obituary will tell you something you didn't know, even about a close relative that you thought you knew.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a sad part of life, that we don't tell stories, we don't share our lives as much as we used to, and it's somewhat poignant that we do it at death, but let's at least do it then. And what I encourage people to do is, just as you pre-plan your funeral, which is of great comfort to the family, why not have this piece written and put it away, hopefully for 25 years, and all you have to do is fill in the date of the passing and when the funeral is. But mm-hmm. You have captured that life in advance, not when there are tears or in your eyes and you're rushing to plan the service.
What about writing your own?
People ask me if I have done my own. I've done my mother's back in January.
I read it.
And I have not done my own, but I have thought deeply about it.
Andrew?
I haven't done my own, and I think part of it is not because of some denial or hesitation about the idea of doing it. It's just the space challenge, because I know so much about my own biography. It's almost like impossible to fit what I would want to say into 14 inches or 18 inches of column space.
You need an editor.
Yeah, I sure do.
Well, we were talking off the air, Andrew. You couldn't hear this conversation off the air. Ken Garfield was mentioning off the air that a lot of loved ones feel the need now, to, particularly in Charlotte, to put everything they've ever done or their loved one ever did in an obituary. Every country club, every accomplishment, every company they worked for, to the point where it becomes almost unreadable. So if somebody is going to write an obit for themselves or for a loved one, what advice would you have for them?
I would think a little bit more about who's reading it. Does your audience, people who don't know the person, really care about every civic club they were in? Maybe you're paying for it, you're the customer, maybe that's what you want to get out there, and you can know that maybe your loved one would want that. But for me, I would think that maybe your loved one and maybe you would like the idea of people reading the obituary. And if all they read is a bunch of accomplishments and resume stuff, their eyes are going to glaze over. So what were they like? What was funny to them? What was their personality? And including maybe some foibles or quirks or even things that some people might find off-putting, if you want to go out that far, and we do, all the time. Mm-hmm. Because perfect people, you just know as a reader that you can't believe that.
I wrote one of a 90-year-old woman in British Columbia who I never met, And they called her the Lucille Ball of the suburbs because she would pick up the remote control and start dialing until she realized it wasn't her phone. And that was in the third paragraph of the obituary because it captured this lighthearted spirit that kept her, that was part of her life until she died at age 90. So I think little vignettes like that tell a lot more about a person than the four jobs she held in the 27 years. Andrew's exactly right. You have to ask yourself, are you writing it for your family or the community? What do you want to do with the obit? I recommend that people celebrate a life and introduce this person to their neighbors and to the community. The short answer is it's a paid obit. You can do what you want in it, but think carefully about what you want to do with that obit.
Because you want people to read it, and you want people to take away from reading. If they're going to spend time reading about a stranger, you want them to take something away.
Correct.
All right, let me bring Wendy and Charlotte into this conversation. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, they started to kind of touch on my question and comment regarding people who write their own obituaries. And what I was wondering is, you know, how do they get to the nugget of truth when someone's written their own obituary? Do they, you know, have they ever had an encounter where they had to kind of dig deeper and maybe find out a little bit more about that person? And, you know, if it wasn't a steadfast, firm thing that someone written, were they able to kind of adapt it to flesh it out more, give it more color or more truth?
For me, most of the time, that's the case. I mean, we have clip files back from the going back to the 40s, and where people will sometimes have dropped off their resumes if they feel like surely one day somebody will want to note what they did, and they are resumes, and there's almost nothing in there about who they were. And you know, you asked Mike a little earlier if we ever run into dead ends. I find if you have a talkative person, a person who likes to talk and is open, a family member, then there's almost never going to be a dead end. The only time when that can happen is if you get somebody who commits to doing it, and then once you start talking to them and you've committed to it, you realize that they're only going to tell you really, really happy stuff and you know, just nothing of substance. That almost never happens, but it can.
I start with a form. When I do everyday people, quote-unquote, obits, I start with a form and ask them to fill it out, and it starts off with basic biographical information, but then it gets to proudest accomplishments, what you want people to remember about you, what mattered most to you. And so interestingly, in those 20, 25-word answers to each question, I start to see the essence of that life, and then we talk about that either by phone or in person, and those stories typically come out. I've never really had one where I didn't feel like I understood or appreciated that person, because mm-hmm. I think people are eager to tell their stories. I think we go through life and we don't get a chance to tell our stories and think about our lives very much.
Wendy, thank you for your call. Let me go to Kurt in Charlotte. Kurt, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. I want to say, first of all, that not everything that Ken said while he was an editor ended up in our red box. I think a lot of it ended up in the heads and hearts of people here in Charlotte. It was a remarkable period of time for that section of the paper under his leadership. But I hear what you're saying and really resonates, but I'm curious if either of the guests have an example of their work so that we could kind of see what the difference is between an obituary and this essence of the life that they're talking about.
I could offer one. There was a dishwasher named Neil Allen Smith who a couple of years ago was killed in a hit-and-run accident. He was, or whatever, a hit-and-run death. He was on his bicycle. Somebody wrote in the comments section on the original sort of police brief, the two-paragraph news item, that somebody who was a dishwasher at this restaurant was 47 years old, basically deserved to die.
Mm. Wow.
The paper, we decided to go ahead and put that comment high up in the story and then go quite in depth about this guy, where he had come from, the fact that he had a twin sister from whom he was estranged, the jobs he had worked, the fact that he had worked for 10 years at one place and minimum wage and never gotten a raise, but always showed up for work. The two-beer gratuity that he sort of acknowledgedly took home as sort of the compensation for the fact that he had minimum wage. anyway, all those things about him and what they were going to do with his ashes. And it generated a flood of positive comments from all over the country and beyond.
I did it. The best part of my job is certainly developing relationships with the people at church, and I've gotten to know a gentleman about my age in the early 60s who's dying of cancer. And so he asked me to do his obituary before he died, and the lead is, based on our conversation, Dave Cribb's wife called him Mr. Happy, a term of endearment that captured his spirit until the day he died at home, surrounded by loved ones. Now, he's still living, but that's their plan. And his nickname was Mr. Happy. And that, as soon as his wife and Barbara told me that, I said, that's what we have to write, that Dave's spirit and grace and calm, even in the face of cancer, it is what we celebrate and what really defined his life. And I ended it with raising a family, selling bonds, going to church, swimming in the hour before dawn. Mr. Cribbs was the same before the cancer and after. Mr. Happy.
Hmm.
To me, that's the difference between ending an obit with memorials can be made too,
right,
and trying to capture who Dave Cribbs was.
Wow.
Okay. Beautiful. Well, Kurt, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. A lot of newsprint is devoted to these. Some are paid, obviously, but a lot of newsprint is devoted to obituaries. And why? Why are they important? Why do readers find them important? I mean, if it's your loved one, I get it. But if you don't know the person, it's a lot of space to devote to somebody people didn't know.
I think it's a representation of community in its most sacred form, that we're all neighbors and we want to know if our neighbor has passed away. I read Monday of a pastor I covered when I was at The Observer who passed away from cancer, who I hadn't seen in years. So I think there is that news. You tap your wife and you say, well, look who died. Mm-hmm. So there is that essentially. I think it's sharing that news. I think the death notices you mentioned, there's a legal aspect to that. When you're doing your trusts and estates, you have to prove a death, so there's part of that. But I think at the core, people want to celebrate their loved ones, and they want to tell their story. And my calling is to help them tell that story in the right way.
A lot of famous people already have, and they're still alive, very much alive, already have their obituaries written. And they're sitting in a drawer or in a computer file someplace, and all that's missing is the date and cause of death, so that it can be printed or put on the air instantly. When you're doing something like that, is it different from sitting there and writing an obituary about an ordinary person who has already passed?
To me, I think that depends on what time you hear about it. You know, if you hear about that famous person at 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock at night, then that pre-written obituary, topped off by a couple of quotes, if you can get them, you know, is what's going to at least be online, and then maybe the next day you have time to do more. But if you hear about it earlier in the day, then though the pre-written obit, hopefully those are just notes, you know, for something that you can do. But Michael Jackson famously died, and the New York Times was able to turn around this massive obit on him on top of the pre-written one they had in something like, I don't know, 2 to 3 hours, a massive obit on Michael Jackson.
I just assumed all that was pre-written. Really?
No,
I'm sure there was one, but, you know, his death wasn't expected, and I don't know. I mean, I know that they did a remarkable job on that one no time to spare.
The smart newspapers bank many obits. I left the paper Ruth Graham, Billy's wife. I left them Tammy Faye Messner. I walked down to get my paper the other morning, and I've been gone from the paper 7 years, and I picked it up, and there was my byline on the front page. I had written George Beverly Shea's obit 7 years ago after he had had a heart attack at age 97. He lasted till he was 104. They get the news late on a weeknight. They don't know what to do, and someone says, oh, I think Ken wrote that obit, and they ran the obit essentially as is 7 years later.
And actually, I've read of instances where the obituary has been filed by the writer who has passed on by the time it runs.
Fortunately, not in this case.
Not in your case, yes.
Art Buchwald did his own video, you know, recently. I died.
Yeah, it's on video, and he says, if you're watching this, I just died.
Right.
He's funny in death, Art Buchwald.
That's a story. That's a line that you know, a philosophy professor of mine once said can't be said.
Andy, you say that for years obituaries were basic. Who, why, when, where? When did that begin to change and why?
I think when in the 80s and 90s, people just started getting more. It maybe has something to do with the baby boomers getting older. I don't know. And, you know, we're kind of a narcissistic generation. Everything we do is important. But in any case, they people just started getting more interested in who people actually were instead of you know, sort of plastic figurines. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So that includes faults. That includes sort of things that it obviously includes things, as in news stories that you wouldn't necessarily consider flattering, but just can't be omitted, or maybe things that might be considered private, but can't be omitted to really tell a story legitimately. And that creates controversy sometimes. You know, I had to write one time about a professor who was prominent in the area, but he had hired Sami El Arian and Ramadan Shalah, two guys who turned out to have strong, you know, Middle Eastern terrorist connections. And I could not have that as part of the story. Yeah, his family wasn't very happy about it.
Yeah. But that plays into something that you've said about the process that you try to do with people, ordinary people that you're writing about, their families. You start with what they did, what they loved, and what made the deceased, and this is the important part, different from every other person who has ever lived.
I've heard that described, too, by one writer as the fingerprints of a person. The phrase, like, you know, and so, yeah, and like Ken said, when you dig deep enough, there those things are, you know, and the people will tell you. The family members will tell you. It has to do a lot with the questions you ask.
And that's true about everybody, isn't it, Ken? Even the most ordinary person who led what most people would say a conventional, unremarkable life, they are different from any other person who has ever lived.
Totally, and there is beauty in the simplicity. So if I write an obit on someone who put their family first, whose greatest moments were spent at the beach or tending their garden in the backyard or barbecuing with their loved one in the backyard, that's very ordinary, but it's very sacred and beautiful to me. And if that's your story, that's your story, and it's a beautiful story, and it's different than the story of the next person.
And you've said that a good obituary will tell even the closest family members something about their loved one they didn't know. And an email from Scott came in saying, I wrote my father's obituary 3 years ago, and in doing so, I discovered an odd truth. I knew a different man than my much older brother and sister. They knew the college professor whose drinking problem had not yet derailed his career, but who was distant and somewhat awkward in his dealings with them. I knew the recovered alcoholic who had lost one career, found another, lost it, and gone back to his first love of teaching. After several years of hell, we had forged the sort of relationship that I wish every father and son could have. How do you find that part of somebody that nobody knows?
You keep at it. You ask that, like you said, you ask the right questions. You put people in that frame of mind that we're going to go beyond the civic and the banking and talk about what really matters to you. It's for everyone I do has an interesting little life story that comes up. Did a gentleman with three ex-wives, does he want to list his, so all three as his survivors? Some family asked me they're estranged from their son. Should they list their son as a survivor?
Okay, we have to take a break. Ken Garfield and Andrew Meacham are with us. We're talking about obituaries. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and dermatology, laser, and vein specialists of the Carolinas welcoming Dr. Olson and Dr. Kazari to the practice, providing state-of-the-art skin care to the Charlotte region. Details at carolinaskin.com. Well, a recent House bill to block the NSA from collecting millions of phone records was narrowly defeated. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about the growing concerns over the scope and oversight of domestic surveillance programs in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. You're invited to join that conversation, as you are ours. We're having a little trouble with our email. I hope by now it's working, but if it is, it's at wfae.org/charlottetalks. That's where you get to Twitter and Facebook and everything else as well. And if it's not working, 704-926-WFAE or 800-603-9323. We're coming right back.
Paul Cardone, owner of Garage Door Guru in Charlotte, talks about underwriting on WFAE.
It's been a very solid business decision for me. Often throughout the day, I'll hear WFAE come up. Someone, either themselves, the person who made the call, or a relative, heard me somehow through WFAE, so it's a nice backdrop to what I do. If you're thinking about WFAE, you know, it makes a lot of sense.
For more information, email underwriting at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In our studio, Ken Garfield with us, Director of Communications for the Myers Park United Methodist Church, former writer with the Charlotte Observer, who spent his fair share of time writing obituaries for the Observer. Still writes a few on occasion. Andrew Meacham is the president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers and the chief epilogue writer for the Tampa Bay Times. We have asked people along the way if they want to share with us something that they learned about somebody that they knew very well in an obituary. That would be interesting to hear about. An email from Chris says, I've noticed the obits in the Charlotte Observer compared to the Chicago Tribune, where I'm from, are much lengthier and more detailed history of family. Here it seems they list everybody. However, it is rarely noted how they died. I've noticed that myself. Cause of death is, particularly for a young person, you want to know what happened. And it's not there. Why not?
You know, does someone need to – my mother had probably 8 causes of death when she passed away at 89. We just said she passed away following a short illness, but she had several illnesses. There's that. There's sometimes there's a sensitive nature. Do you list a suicide? Do you list a drug overdose? Do you list a murder?
But other papers do.
Some do. It's, you know, again, it's your obit. You can – and you're paying for it. You can list it how you want. I ask people, you know, does the community need to know the cause of death? Is that part of this story here? Oftentimes you can get it from the memorials. If it's American Cancer Society, a gift can be made, then you kind of have an idea what was the cause was. So it depends if it's a public figure or if it's an everyday person.
What's your take on that, Andrew?
Well, work for a newspaper, so we have to, if somebody committed suicide, that's a deal breaker if we can't say that they committed suicide. If they were murdered, absolutely the same way. Somebody who died young, if they were 99, I think we can just say they died. But more, I mean, I even feel like if they were in their 80s, at least a lingering illness, an illness of some kind, I agree with what Ken's premise, I think you were saying, Ken, that it's really about the life, not the death. And
right.
Some people take that to such an extreme that they believe that the cause of death isn't important at all. It shouldn't even be mentioned. But I think the more you want to raise, you want to answer questions rather than raise questions. So you don't want the reader stopping and going, wait a minute, they're 29 years old and they died? How did that happen? So I think where there's a question that's going to be raised, you want to answer.
Now,
that.
Are you talking about the obituaries, the ordinary, the common man obits that you write from time to time?
Absolutely.
But you're not talking about the paid obits. You're talking, because that's up to the people.
Well, the paid obits are, you know, what the family wants to say, and they often do. I mean, they rarely say that they took their own life in a paid obit. If they took their own life, sometimes they do because they have a cause.
So when the Observer had a regular columnist, and I've forgotten her name, excuse me,
Jerry Hostetler,
yes, who wrote once a week about mm-hmm. somebody who had died, an ordinary person, and she never, I don't think, mentioned cause of death in those. In those obituaries. Why do we have this difference in philosophy between the Tampa Bay newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times, and the Charlotte Observer? Why is there a difference in philosophy?
You know, it depends on the newspaper, the editor, the writer. I think it probably depends on the sort of the gentility of the community. Charlotte's quite a genteel town. It's very polite and courteous. And it
Tampa's
probably,
not?
I've not lived there, Andrew would have to say. But, you know, I think that speaks a little bit to the culture of Charlotte and to be discreet and to be respectful of people's privacy. Andrew's exactly right. If you're writing a news obituary of someone, you give the cause of death. Paid obituary, it's up to you. Mm-hmm. But even in that context, if I'm helping someone with their obituary, it just depends. If they're very, very old and they've had lots of different sort of maladies, then you just say they died following a short or long illness. If there is cancer, the Dave Cribbs obit I just read, the way he dealt with cancer with a certain grace is part of his life story. So you do bring in the cancer.
Yeah. Okay. Tom from Albemarle was on the phone but couldn't hold. He's a longtime Observer employee. A longtime Observer employee, Bruce Rogers, died recently at 105. And he says only got a very small short obit, just a couple of lines. Why didn't he receive more, especially since he worked for the paper for 50 years? You don't work there anymore. You probably can't answer that question.
Don't work there. Can't say that. I've done stories on people who are over 100. There are many, many more of them. They take them case by case. Is it sad that the Observer and other newspapers don't write more unique obituaries? Absolutely. They're beautiful stories, and that's wonderful storytelling. For economic reasons, lack of space, they don't write as many as they used to, so someone like that doesn't get written about.
Because of what he just said, Andrew, and because you're the president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers, are these ordinary people obituaries migrating somewhere else, not the newspaper, maybe to the newspaper's websites or to websites devoted exclusively to this kind of writing?
They're certainly migrating to places like Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know, people create memorial pages, and their friends and so forth will comment, and then I guess that's comforting to the family when somebody's death or memorial page receives 2,000 likes. So that's one place. I also think that because of the featurization, if that's a word, of regular obits and regular people, that you start to see more storytelling in the paid obits. You know, they're starting to talk more about what they were like and their sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of a sense of what it was to know them, their hobbies. And those were things you didn't see not so long ago.
Well, if you look back over the history of obituary writing, there have been trends, and the style of these obituaries has changed over the years. I know that in the 1800s there was a fascination with the afterlife, and a lot of people went to mediums and tried to contact their deceased loved ones, and obituaries reflected that trend in popular culture back then. They were kind of ghoulish in a way. So we're moving to this pop culture kind of thing, talking about human beings as human beings now.
You know, when I work with families, did a person die? Did they pass away? Did they go off to be with Jesus? Did they go to be with the angels? It's the language that you want to use that speaks a lot to what your faith is or lack of faith.
Mm-hmm. I've often
that
wondered.
Actually,
go ahead. I'm sorry, Andrew.
Oh, that actually started in the around the turn of the century, the 19th to 20th century. People used to put black sort of crepe ribbons on doors. They were called death badges to signify that that was the place where somebody there was a death in that household. And then between 1890 and 1900, the colors started changing to light grays or lavender, and flowers started coming into funerals, and some people thought that was inappropriate because it was supposed to be solemn. But gradually and more, the concept of celebration has taken over with people. They want death to be a kind of a happy occasion.
Because they're passing into something, a new chapter, essentially, a better place.
Yeah.
You wrote your mother's obituary, and I read it yesterday, Ken Garfield. How difficult was that? Was it therapeutic? Did you have to fight to write it? Did you learn something about your mother in the course of talking to people about her that you didn't know when you wrote that?
It was I wouldn't say therapeutic. It was a privilege. It was an honor. I have a brother who's a doctor and a sister who was the caregiver, so it fell to me to do the obit, obviously. I considered it an honor, a privilege. Yes, I learned some things I did not know. to sit there maybe 3 or 4 weeks before she passed away and write it was obviously with tears in my eyes was, I guess, privilege and honor. When we were done and all the siblings approved it, we asked her if she wanted to read it, and she said no. I think she might have put another word in front, but she did not want to read it. She trusted it with us. And I will tell you that when the funeral home director said, okay, now let's start working on the obit, it was an absolute, I wouldn't say joy, but it was such a reward to just be able to hand her this piece that we were happy with.
Let me ask you this, because in that case, you have relationships, long-term relationships with the people in your mother's life that you could consult with and come to terms with, as you said, after everybody approved it. But when you're writing a common man obituary, and you have done interviews with the family, you're going to come across conflicting stories or conflicting opinions or statements of fact that may prove not to be so. How do you handle that?
That's a great. I did one on a guy who said he made a huge gift to a charitable institution, and the institution said, well, no, it wasn't exactly that big. So what did I do? I went with what the gentleman told me. It's a paid obit. It is his telling of his story. And I think in some cases, not very often, you do have to take some of it with a grain of salt. You want to be kind and gentle. This was a gentleman that was virtually alone in life, so I did not have loved ones to really confirm facts to point me in the right direction. So it was just his retelling of his story, and you do the best you can, and you try to rise above the facts and how much money he gave this institution to say what really mattered to this gentleman. And what mattered to him was that he was a success in life.
But when you decide to do a piece, when Jerry used to do these pieces for the paper, when you do them, Andrew, for the Tampa Bay Times, how much vetting goes into the facts that you learn from people, and how do you vet it? Because these are not famous
people. You can't in a day. I mean, you really can't go drop in and fact check everything. So you can attribute if there's any question their family said or someone in the family said. But yeah, I've been burned before like that. I had somebody who was a psychologist and had all kinds of accomplishments, including being a senior athlete with records in the hammer throw and the discus. And it turned out, and I didn't know this in the one day, and the family never offered it up, that this person had formerly been male, but then became female. You know, and that would have put some things in a different light. I would have loved to have known that. That's a rather significant thing not to have in the person's obituary. I was crushed when I found out.
You know, as dead, we're taught not to speak ill of the dead, but dead or not, not everybody was nice. Not everybody led an exemplary life. You're going to find out that there are people certainly who have character. Everybody has character flaws, but some people have criminal behavior in their background.
Correct.
What do you do about that?
I mean, for me, those are some of my favorite ones. I mean, I wrote once about a guy that dealt drugs, and he died in a police chase when he crashed. But I was able to find out from his sister about his personality growing up and who he was, and kind of the when his parents started to spot trouble. But also it reflects in a larger sense about the trouble that people have when they get out of jail and actually try to get a job, as he did many, many, many times, and just how dispiriting, defeating that is.
I think you put things into context. The Helen Thomas, the famous White House correspondent who died, they obviously had a mention that her career ended with an anti-Semitic rant that cost her job. That was near the end. In the Billy Graham obit, which many of us have already written, where do you include his apology for his anti-Semitic comments on tape to Richard Nixon? I think that's part of the Billy Graham story, as long as it's done carefully and within the context of a larger life. And I think that's the important part.
What kind of feedback? Right. What kind of feedback do you get from family and members and friends who may have read the obituary of the loved one that you wrote? Is it mostly positive? Is it some negative? And how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the fact that maybe you made a mistake? You can't really retract it. There's no reason to print that retraction. How do you deal with that?
Well, Andrew's different than me because he's writing on deadline for a newspaper. I'm writing for the family, so I let them fact check and vet it, and I don't stop until they're exactly happy with it. So it's a little different than me.
You have to. First of all, obits are jam-packed with facts, I think more so than a lot of stories. I mean, in a short space, you're dealing with all kinds of things, job changes, companies that have changed names, colleges that have changed names, and every little thing that you get wrong, it may well have to be noted in a printed correction because the paper stands on being accurate. You also can't say to a family member, next time he dies, I'll get it right, as Jim Nicholson said. So there's an additional pressure to get things right, and I go through all kinds of checks. You know, calendar dates and facts alleged, math, you know, could they really have been 37 years old if they were born in X year? And then we say he did this at X time, you know. But I don't know. It's a nightmare sometimes in terms of the anxiety. And as far as the payoff from family members, yeah, because you're doing something rather special for them, and often in their eyes, it's maybe the last thing ever written, you get a lot of grateful responses. But by the same token, you've got to live with the fact that if they really don't like it, they really don't like it. And, so that's a small percentage of the reactions I get, but they can be quite intense.
I wish we had time to talk about the Grimmies, the Society of Professional Obituary Writers annual award. It's called the Grimmies, but we don't have time for that. Lynn emails, a friend of mine had a very controlling mother, controlling until the very end, including writing her own obituary. We guess she must have angered the people at the newspaper because when the obituary ran in the paper, instead of saying she went to be with the Lord, it said she went to be the Lord. Andrew Meacham is president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers and the chief epilogue writer of the Tampa Bay Times, and Ken Garfield, a longtime Observer writer, now director of communications with Myers Park United Methodist. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.